That was Outer National with Decisions, and that's a topic we all got to be spending a lot of time thinking about, the decisions we got to make and what we got to do. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. As the year ends, I want to take a look back at one of the important issues that we've talked about here, the genocidal mass incarceration of black and brown people. We're going to spend most of the hour listening to an interview I did with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of the book From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. In the United States today, one in every 31 adults is under some form of penal control, including one in 11 African-American men. Now, how did this supposed land of the free become the home of the world's largest prison system? In a work vivid with detail and sharp analysis, Elizabeth Hinton challenges the accepted belief that mass incarceration originated with the Reagan administration. Rather, she traces its rise to an ironic source, the social welfare programs of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society at the height of the civil rights era. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
So I wanted to ask you this. Why this book?
Well, I grew up in the 1980s. I am kind of on the older side of the millennial generation. So I witnessed firsthand the impact of crack and crime on my family. But I also understood the larger socioeconomic context that led some members of my family to go in and out of prison. And it wasn't until I was much older, in my 20s in graduate school, that I began to visit family and loved ones in prison in the state of California. And a lot of us who have incarcerated family members feel a lot of shame about that. So it took me a while to be able to actually go visit them and come to terms with it in a different way. And when I stepped onto the campus of High Desert State Prison in Susanville, California, I was just astounded. This was in 2005, and this was at a time when mass incarceration itself wasn't talked about. It wasn't quite the catchphrase that it is now. It was way more invisible. And I could not believe what I saw, which is generations of mostly black and brown men behind bars, interacting with their families and their children, and in this carceral place where guards are watching your every move, they won't let you touch. The process of going to visit somebody means that you're criminalized yourself in the search and in the registration for visitation. And I really wanted to try to understand how we got to this place. How in the United States of America, the so-called land of the free, where all of us are created equal, were entire groups and entire generations of men of color behind bars. I wanted to understand the historical process that made it happen. So that's kind of the personal aspect. The other is that I had studied in undergraduate, and I wanted to study in graduate school the Black Power movement, Black Power politics. I was really interested in the 1960s and what happened to the promises of civil rights. And I noticed as I began to kind of dive into various Black Power organizations that there was a real gap in the literature and the historiography on Black Power and in that era on the transformation of federal policies. We had a much better understanding of groups like the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army and Stokely Carmichael, but we kind of lacked this understanding of the ways in which racism still profoundly shaped federal policy after the civil rights movement. So I started to kind of come to this question of how did the federal government ultimately respond to the civil rights movement and the enlightened protests of the 1960s, and this kind of turn towards punitive policy emerged for me as the foremost answer to that question.
Now, one of the things that really struck me too is that you start with this more than 50 years ago, more or less, Lyndon Johnson called for a war on crime. And since then, prisons, and actually, was he the war on crime or war on poverty?
He declared both. And that was one of the kind of surprises for me as I began the research. We don't talk about Johnson's role as kind of the architect of modern American law enforcement, but he was the first in 1965, the week before he sent the Voting Rights Act to Congress, to declare an all-out war on crime. So this was a year after he declares the war on poverty. The next year, he follows it up with this declaration of a war on crime.
You make a point where that since then, prisons, jails, law enforcement institutions, they've all functioned as actually the central engine of a big part of American society. Let's talk about that.
The way that I see it, in part, there was a crisis. There was a social and kind of demographic and structural crisis going on in the 1960s. Cities are transforming. Middle class and especially white residents are increasingly moving to the suburbs, and you have a growing population of low-income African-American youth who are coming into major parts of significant American cities like Cleveland by the early 1960s. Black Americans, about a third of the population. Detroit, in Washington, D.C., of course, they had just come into a majority in the 1960s. And at the same time, this is the moment when domestic manufacturing is really starting to decline, and plants in the former kind of Midwest and Rust Belt are closing. So here you have this kind of growing population of low-income people of color, and there aren't jobs for them. And so this begins to become a real issue that policymakers are concerned about in the Kennedy administration. They say, okay, we have to do something about what's going on in American cities, because these black youth, and this is what Kennedy officials and social scientists used to call them, this group is social dynamite, and if we don't provide programs for them, they're going to explode. Initially, this comes in the form of juvenile delinquency programs in the Kennedy administration, and then Johnson kind of expands this into a larger war on poverty that's implemented nationwide. At the same time, Johnson kind of offers this carrot and the stick approach, which is these kind of softer social programs, social welfare programs, but also the kind of rise of new police programs, the beginnings of the militarization of urban police forces. It's not during the war on terror, which many people thought, to explain how we got the kind of armored tanks that we saw in Ferguson and the military rifles. This actually begins in the 1960s in the context of the Vietnam War. And so Johnson begins this at the same time, initiating this massive and very promising and important social program. So Johnson kind of plants the seeds of this punitive response to problems of failing public schools and unemployment and deteriorating housing conditions. And eventually, these kind of crime control programs begin to take precedence over the social welfare programs. So we really see this transition take hold very firmly during the Nixon administration, where social welfare programs are defunded. Crime control programs, Congress gives them greater and greater allocations, and eventually, under the Department of Justice and the grant-making administration that Johnson sets up called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, programs that had been previously administered by the Office of Economic Opportunity come to be administered by law enforcement officials. So you get things like employment programs or after-school programs that increasingly police are running by the 1970s. So in terms of the engine of inequality, it's part of this approach that policymakers began to take in the 1960s at the federal level, that is a response to socioeconomic conditions and poverty with police and surveillance, and then eventually incarceration.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America.
When Johnson came into power, there was actually an upsurge of rebellion that happened in this country. Johnson was very, very, very afraid of what were these things harbingers of? What were they? What did they say about the future? He was very, very, very motivated by the fact that he needed to keep the people that he saw as the people that actually could strike at the heart of the system. There was a real fear of what would spread if something wasn't done.
Right. And that's actually a central part of my argument. It's interesting that the social dynamite that Kennedy and then Johnson officials feared did indeed explode in the absence of major structural changes in 1964. There was a series of unrest uprisings beginning with Harlem, Philadelphia, Chicago, Rochester, New York, where the National Guard was actually deployed. And this was kind of the first moment that the social dynamite exploded on a mass basis. And I see Johnson's call for the war on crime that previous spring as a preemptive measure to prevent future unrest. And this is part of why he was so concerned with getting urban police forces with military-grade weapons in order to better manage these uprisings should they occur in cities. And as the war on crime escalates and more money becomes allocated to the war on crime, the uprisings do indeed increase. Simultaneously, the programs of the war on poverty are being increasingly entangled with police officers, and they're taking on new roles in social programs. So in the first year of the war on poverty, it was steered by this really amazing principle of maximum feasible participation. And the idea was that federal grants would go directly to local organizations, and local organizations would determine the causes and the solutions to poverty in their communities on their own terms. And increasingly, in the aftermath of especially the Watts Uprising, in the summer of 65, those autonomous grassroots organizations are increasingly forced to partner with municipal authorities and more formal organizations in order to receive federal funding. Johnson eventually requires that programs like model cities, community action programs, partner with and include police officers and law enforcement, as well as local authorities in their decision-making process. So the war on poverty itself has this kind of moment where, early moment where grassroots organizations are kind of able to use these federal funds on their own terms or receiving federal funding directly, and that quickly begins to change.
These people that were in power actually had they shared a certain view. There was a big picture that was painted by the people that are in charge of things about this is the threat that decent people are facing, a threat from the bottom that's occupied by black and brown people, and it's got to be dealt with in whatever way we can. And there's a lot of different moves that went in there, the Safe Streets Act and these other things, and a whole declaration of a war on crime. What he did is not well known. You really actually document a lot of that, and it's actually a stunner when you hit it.
Right. There's much to say about that. I mean, in terms of Johnson, in many ways, he's kind of most remembered for his Vietnam legacy. In terms of his domestic policy, clearly the Civil Rights Package that he offered, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But we forget the punitive domestic policy that he introduces with the first major piece of federal crime control legislation, which is the Safe Streets Act of 1968, which in hindsight now that we are the largest incarcerator on the planet and that many of the gains of the civil rights movement have come undone as a result of the crime control policies of the last 50 some years, in many respects, his legacy in terms of crime control and law enforcement remains more enduring than some of the civil rights gains, even though that legislation is obviously landmark legislation. It's unprecedented. That's something that I'm asking us to come to terms with. I think that part of why, in terms of the assumptions, that led to the fundamental shortcomings of the war on poverty, because I believe, and this is based on my evaluation of the White House Central Files of the administrations that I deal with in the book, the question of the degree to which the federal government was going to commit to structural transformation was still being debated in the Kennedy administration. And that was essentially solved in the Johnson administration because of the influence of social scientists on policymakers, people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who worked for the Department of Labor during Kennedy and Johnson, and had a very influential, initially internal report called On the Negro Family that he wrote in the spring of 1965, at the same time that Johnson's getting ready to declare the war on crime. And he basically recognizes the kind of structural impediments that African Americans had faced in the United States from slavery onwards. But he ultimately argues that black poverty is the result of cultural pathology, that these cultural pathologies stemming from slavery get transmitted from one generation to the next. So Johnson and his advisors say, oh, okay, we can fight this war on poverty. If black poverty is the result of pathology, we can do this relatively cheaply. We don't need a major structural program. We can, in the words of Johnson's Attorney General Ramsey Clark, we can help the disadvantaged help themselves. We can provide job training programs. We don't need to do job creation programs. We can teach single mothers how to make breakfast for their kids and clean up their homes. So it ends up being this attempt to, and this is even language that policymakers themselves use, make low-income Americans, and especially black Americans, into productive citizens. It's not really, despite this kind of grand title of a war on poverty, an attempt to overhaul American society and initiate a major redistribution of resources and or wealth.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. At some point that changed in a way where that wasn't even being considered, even if they put sugar on it when they put it out. The reality of what they were talking about when they talked amongst themselves and they came up with all these things, and when they set their police free on people, they weren't actually talking about the niceties of all this. They were saying, go out and kick some butt.
Yeah, and as the uprisings of the 1960s, which happened in every summer of Johnson's presidency, escalate, liberal sympathizers to social programs, the war on poverty, begin, and Johnson himself, begin to move further and further away from this idea that the fundamental root causes of the unrest. And Ramsey Clark and other Johnson officials were very aware when they went out on the street in Watts and talked to people that unemployment and exploitive and exclusionary institutions in South Central and Detroit and Newark were really what had inspired people, residents, to rise up. And the kind of constant threat and the constant material reality of these uprisings really push policymakers to say, okay, we're not going to be able to solve these problems in a short period of time. We've got to do something to control crime right now. We've got to do something to squash this unrest. And so we need to begin to focus more and take more seriously supporting our law enforcement authorities in patrolling and surveilling these groups of citizens that could potentially erupt at any moment.
And that included things like, for instance, these groups that became these police groups that became notorious killers, and they were Nazi torturers of great masses of people. And it was all based on the people's nationality. I mean, you had everything from, was it Stress was one group, and then
in Detroit. Yeah.
And then there were a few others going in through the 60s all the way through, where you had these various groups that were inside the police. I was thinking of, okay, like the crash units, you know, here and what it does, and it's the legacy of it and what it did to people. I mean, I stayed in the neighborhood when I first got here with the vast majority of guys from 16 to 25 had disappeared. Why? They're in jail. And you think about what was unleashed under Johnson and then further through Nixon, which was, you know, we'll get into that in a minute because that really ratchets things up. Mm-hmm. But that was a pretty heavy aspect of all of this.
Right. I mean, units like STRESS, which is an acronym for Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets in Detroit, which was essentially a plainclothes undercover unit that sought to bait criminals into robbing these police officers to prevent crime before it happened, and then manifestations of anti-gang units like CRASH here in Los Angeles, are really based, and this goes into this idea of preemptive, on these assumptions that basically, all black youth, especially black men, between the ages of 15 and 24 are all potential criminals. Because one of the major findings of the book is that policymakers essentially decided, and this had a lot to do with the profile of the quote-unquote typical rioter that policymakers stuck with, whether or not it was actually true, was a young black kid between the ages of 15 and 24, and policymakers held this group as responsible for the majority of the nation's crime. They begin to label, even in the Johnson administration, this group of youth as potential delinquents and begin to target them through programs. So that's part of the logic that led to police officers taking a greater role, because they say, okay, we need to have police officers in these after-school programs that are monitoring or responsible for these quote-unquote potential delinquents. So this concept of potential crime, that policymakers essentially is obsessed with preventing potential crime or future crime or what will happen in the future, becomes enshrined in the first major piece of juvenile justice legislation in 1974. And a potential delinquent is defined as, in this congressional legislation, any youth who lives in public housing, who attends an urban public school, who has a brother and sister or family member who has a criminal record, or who is living in a house that receives public assistance. So this basically labels any kid living in the hood as a potential delinquent. And police officers are expected to prevent future crimes from happening among this potential delinquent population by constantly asserting their presence among them.
Well, there was a whole culture that was formed around this, the whole culture that was more than individual policies, but it was a whole culture that was focused up around black people at that time. And when you think about that, in conjunction with, we talked about the rebellions, but there was also the things like the Panthers here. You have some stuff in your book about the Panthers and the assault on the Panthers by the LAPD and the various other forces that were involved in that. The things you brought together actually were some new things to me in terms of what was actually done and the tie-in between the kind of raids that the one that they pulled down here in South Central, the tie-in between that and this whole program that went through successive generations of rulers in this country and was all aimed at getting black people, corralling them, and downpressing them.
Right. I mean, it's the fear that has existed among white elites in the United States from slavery, the fear of black rebellion, the fear of what are free black populations going to do? And I think it's very significant. So there's this fear of dissent, this fear of radical protest. And it's very significant that we get the kind of showcase of this new militarized urban police forces first asserting themselves against black radicals. So the SWAT team, the nation's first SWAT team, premieres here in Los Angeles in 1969 at the Black Panther Party headquarters. And of course, local police forces working with the FBI are raiding Panther offices, etc. And then, once the movement is quelled in many respects, those practices become kind of the foremost strategies of the war on drugs during the Nixon administration. So we see those kind of raids not just happening against black radicals and other radicals of color, student radicals, but we see them happening against petty black drug dealers.
There is this point, too, though, from the very beginning, the impact this had on the lives of the masses of people. And it's really important that people understand this, because you're always told that, oh, well, you know, the war on drugs was a war on drugs. It wasn't, you know, come on, it wasn't anything more than that. These people were poor and they did things that they shouldn't have done and they should have known better. And after all, yes, some of them were downpressed, but then other people, well, didn't they actually get taken up and weren't they given training and didn't this happen and didn't that happen to make their lives better? And what you reveal in the book is no.
Right. Part of it has to do with the kind of theory behind the policy. So Johnson, unlike Nixon, this is kind of a transition between the two administrations. Johnson believed that poverty was the root cause of crime, which it is. But because he saw black pathology as the root cause of poverty, his domestic programs were doomed to fail. Nixon eventually, and it becomes widely accepted by the Carter administration, crime is eventually seen by policymakers as the root cause of poverty. The consequences of that lead to this kind of massive roundup that manifests in mass incarceration.
It's when you're looking at this and you're thinking, okay, Nixon's legacy ratcheted everything up. Well, let's jump into Nixon, because this was a major turning point, and it was really, it's a major leap, and it had a lot to do, I think, with like what was going on among the people in the society, particularly at that time. Black people were on the forefront of actually challenging a lot of the oppression and the suffering that people have, and also pointing out we don't have to live this way. To me, there was a question of, you get Nixon's legacy, and that ratchets everything up. Let's talk about what that means, that it ratcheted everything up.
So kind of thinking about this from a more theoretical perspective and about Johnson's legacy, I mean, one of the things, to be fair to Johnson and Kennedy, and it took me a while weighing the documents and thinking through this to really kind of pinpoint, I believe that the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, even though they were misguided, really had good intentions behind their policies, that there are a lot of unintended consequences. The problem is that liberal social policy was and has been and continues to be limited by these sets of racial assumptions. Racism, essentially. They were unable to really come to terms, these policymakers, with their own racism and the ways in which that shaped the range of possibilities, as we've talked about, for domestic policy. When we get to Nixon, we begin to see a more kind of intentionally targeted policy that operates along the lines of black people, poor people, people of color, black and Latinos are inherently criminal, and we gotta somehow remove them from society. So this is where, you know, we get these quotes from Nixon where he says, the whole problem, he tells his chief of staff, Harry Haldeman, the whole problem is really the blacks, and the key is to devise a system that recognizes this without appearing to. And I think this is a really important quote. Recently, it came out that he made comments to John Ehrlichman about the war on drugs was really just this kind of cover to arrest hippies and black people. So there is a more intentional, sinister aspect to Nixon's policies. And what he does is take the kind of punitive elements, the crime control programs that Johnson introduces and runs with them. And we've kind of touched on this, but he ends up expanding them while at the same time disinvesting from social welfare programs, attempting to disband the Office of Economic Opportunity, calling a moratorium on public housing construction. And we're beginning to kind of see this turn back to policy now, where punitive measures are seen as the kind of only means to deal with problems of poverty, inequality, and the consequences of unequal distribution of resources.
In many places, it's come out that Nixon actually had said these things. Well, actually, the problem is the blacks, and we have right. to actually recognize, we have to get away of making that point
right.
and acting on that without actually saying that. But the right. problem is the blacks,
right.
you know, and
right.
in a big sense, that's actually what was going on here. And mm-hmm. and even with Johnson, frankly, Johnson, you know, I wouldn't give Kennedy or Johnson as many inches as you gave them, all right? But because I think they were very conscious of what was going on. Johnson was actually he was pretty clear about the moves he had to make to do, you know, in terms of what he was doing in society. And he was scared to death when the rebellions happened. He
yes.
became extremely scared of, like, mm-hmm. what is he going to be responsible for and what is being unleashed in the society.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a big element of that, you know, when you talk about all of these people, is that we have to convince people that black people are the problem, and there's one or two ways to deal with that.
Right. And part of that is is deploying police officers and allowing police officers to act in ways that completely assumes that entire communities are criminal. I mean, what we really begin to see in the Nixon administration is, as a result of these disinvestments that I've been discussing and kind of the strategies that are promoted at the federal level and imposed on local authorities, is the identification and the arrest of criminals and potential criminals.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America.
When you're talking about this, look at the fact that at one point, white people made up the majority of people in jail.
And that begins to change during the Nixon administration.
Very dramatically.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
So the thing that gets introduced, I think, most consequentially in terms of thinking about mass incarceration is a massive prison construction project. So again, this goes into the ways in which these policies, these crime control and law enforcement policies, are based on potential crime or projected crime. Nixon calls the Bureau of Prisons to completely overhaul the prisons at the federal level as a model for the states. And they begin to make these projections of what the prison population will be. In 1970, they begin to make these projections of what prisons will be in 1980. And those projections are based, again, on projections that had been made by the Kerner Commission and the Crime Commission on the ways in which the population of black youth would grow. So they're based on, again, that troublesome population for policymakers, which is how many black youth are in this country between the ages of 15 and 24 that are really the kind of group that's responsible for most of the nation's crime, as policymakers believed. So based on these projections of black youth populations, which later proved to be false in the mid-70s, Nixon begins this major prison construction project and basically incentivizes states to start building prison. When I came across these planning documents in the Nixon archives, they were very chilling to me, because the idea is that mass incarceration arose because there were real crime problems and it was just kind of the natural response to what was going on in the ground. And here you see policymakers actually building prisons based on what might happen in the future. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how you can project for prison populations. The tragic irony of this, and this again reflects these general priorities and this intentionality and the racism of these policies. The Congressional Research Service in the mid-70s began to draw correlations between unemployment and prison populations. And so instead of using unemployment rates to say, okay, why don't we provide people with jobs so they won't turn to crime, the Bureau of Prisons and the Nixon and Ford administrations begin to say, okay, so based on our unemployment rates, we need to build more prisons. I mean, that is the link for me right there. And the real failure of our domestic policies of the past 50 years.
Yeah, and you look at that. I mean, even just to throw out a little bit more on this, there's a whole thing here of, look, when we were talking about white people and black people and the difference in the way that they were treated, white people, when they got busted for drugs, it was a whole different scene. When you're talking about the population as a whole, it was a whole different scene, because among black people, it became one of the early gateways following in the wake of the first bringing black people over in these ships and, you know, condemning them to slavery, and then, you know, everything else that happened to them up until now that's still going on. You know, there's a lot that went on here that white people had the same attraction to drugs. There were a lot of white people doing drugs, hard drugs, fun drugs, whatever. There were a lot of white people that were part of that drug culture. But among black people, black people as a whole became the focus of the assault. And it was tied into this whole question of a whole culture that was built up and put out in relation to black people and the threat that they posed to this system and what needed to be done in relation to them.
Right. I mean, there's so much to say about that. Just in terms of where we are today with it, I mean, white people actually use marijuana at higher rates than black Americans do, yet black people are more likely to be in prison for drugs. They're more likely to be sentenced for longer. I mean, and this goes for Latinos, too. One of the ways that the kind of disparities in criminal justice really begin to crystallize are actually in the juvenile delinquency policies that we get in the 1970s. And I think this is a really profound example of the dynamic that you're talking about, where white people receive completely different treatment in the criminal justice system. And we're beginning to see this today, again, with meth. So essentially, the Juvenile Delinquency Act in 1974 is progressive in the sense that it deinstitutionalizes status offenses. So as youth incarceration increases in the just about 10 years, in the first 10 years of the war on crime, white youth are also getting ensnared in the system. So youth who are runaways or who are living in poor homes with parents who are unable to take care of them, instead of having an alternative, they're increasingly sent to juvenile detention centers with more hardened criminals. And so Congress steps in and wants to kind of pull these youth out of that system and to put them into halfway houses or foster care and not kind of criminalize them in prison. So these youth, these quote-unquote troublesome youth, runaway youth, there's a whole program for runaway youth, these kind of labels are increasingly associated with white youth, whereas black youth and Latino youth are increasingly labeled delinquent and sent to public prisons. Congress begins to fund a new kind of rehabilitation private sector to help these troublesome youth. The thing is that these kind of rehabilitative programs, these prevention programs, aren't located in urban areas. They're located in places like Montana. They're located in more rural areas. They're located in some suburban areas. And so even if judges want to send a low-income youth of color to a rehab facility instead of a public kiddie prison, he or she has no choice but to send them to that kiddie prison because there isn't the kind of fundamental rehabilitation program in the community. So we really begin to see the kind of rise of private sector rehab that overwhelmingly serves white youth and rural youth. And those programs aren't funded and implemented in the same way in low-income urban communities. So this kind of outrage we're beginning to see and this kind of rehab versus punitive approach in the ways in which policymakers are responding to the opioid crisis and meth, which is disproportionately used by white citizens. You know, we didn't get this response to crack cocaine abuse, which is disproportionately associated with black citizens, for rehabilitation, for medical care, all kinds of things that are serving increasingly white or disproportionately white populations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you're talking, I was thinking about this. Nixon, one of the things with Nixon is this black cultural pathology mm-hmm. is the cause of crime, mm-hmm. which I think is actually really important for people to think about and get into, because that lays the basis for actually not just the oppression, the continued oppression of black people, but actually the genocidal assault on black people as a people. You know, because after all, there's something culturally, pathologically wrong with them, and that's what actually is the cause of crime. That's that was a very heavy thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Nixon really embraces the idea that somehow, and when I say Nixon, I'm also talking about officials in his administration and many members of Congress and the federal government, really begin to embrace this idea. As crime continues to escalate in the era of the war on crime, that black people are somehow inherently, innately criminal. And instead of reevaluating these programs, which had failed because the underlying structural issues that lead to crime remained unaddressed, policymakers continued to just throw more money at incarceration, surveillance, and policing. And under this idea that, okay, well, nothing works, there's nothing that can be done to help these people, and to kind of get into the mindset of Nixon and like-minded policymakers, and so our only option is to police them and incarcerate them. And that's part of the logic that leads to his kind of major $500 million, which is like $1.5 billion in today's dollars, prison construction project that gets initiated in 1970. These programs, these ideas, lay the groundwork for Reagan and the war on drugs. I think a lot of people kind of assume that mass incarceration and the types of policing that we're more aware of today that have been going on for some time emerge with Reagan. And really, Reagan steps into a process that began with the Johnson administration and that really took on an entirely new level, especially with respect to prisons and incarceration during the Nixon administration.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. There's a couple of questions I want to ask you before that, because I read them in your book, and I have to speak to these before we get into it, and we'll wrap it up with talking about Reagan, but I really want to, James Q. Wilson, okay? Yeah, got to talk about him. This cat said, the only sure way we know of to fight crime is birth control.
Yeah, I mean, that is precisely that attitude that black people are inherently criminal and that we got to lock them up, essentially, and we got to police them and prevent I mean, this is where entire communities get criminalized. This is where these ideas of potential criminality materialize, you know, that crime, that any resident in these communities are potentially criminal and that they need to be identified and monitored to prevent crime from happening before it actually occurs. So a lot of these policies and these actions aren't based on actual crime, but the idea of crime, and that those ideas of crime become, and you know, one could argue they've always been linked to blackness, but really become linked to black poverty in new ways after the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Another name, which is, these names just, they're like, you know, they just, it's like you bury them and you stomp it down, you cover it up and they still pop out. Charles Murray. Yeah.
So again, I mean, so Murray and basically conducts this study that argues that that rehabilitation doesn't work. This is in the late 70s. So this is, again, kind of setting up this real turn to the decline of rehabilitative services, or really an embrace of an idea that prisons can actually help people. And then I'm talking about, from the perspective of policymakers, help people become better citizens, or that prisoners should re-enter society. And so this is part of the shoring up of mandatory minimum sentences, the kind of lock them up and throw away the key mentality. Murray conducts this study and basically argues that rehab doesn't work, so we need to just incarcerate repeat offenders or people who have had a lot of contacts with police and lock them up for a very, very long time.
Yeah. Remarkable guy.
Not to
yeah.
mention the kind of pathological assumptions that come up in his later work that are clearly, I think, very much shaping his work on incarceration and prisoners.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because I was going to push you in that direction. It's really important that people know that. And it's, you know, it's just incredible. All right, one thing, the transition to Reagan. To me, this is really a huge thing, because in a way, Reagan, reflecting the needs of U.S. imperialism at the time, and to a certain extent, sharper today even in terms of the same needs, we can look at the horse's ass that's in the White House and understand, like, okay, we're in trouble. And okay, black people are in trouble. I went to see the movie Detroit, which I thought was a really good movie. I really liked it a lot, because I thought the exposure of it was really, mm-hmm. really important. And so many people don't know mm-hmm. about that, you know? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're realizing that there's this stuff that's actually going on today that's really important for people to understand. And a lot of it is rooted in what went down with Reagan and how Reagan fundamentally changed the whole picture and laid the basis for what's going on since then.
I see Reagan in a lot of ways as bringing to fruition a lot of the kind of ideas that had been floated around as early as the Johnson administration, and we begin to see this kind of complete withdrawal or retreat or retrenchment from social welfare programs whatsoever. So that really, in many communities in the U.S., the police officers really become the last public institution standing. They represent, and this kind of sets the era of the kind of height of crash and what led to the 92 rebellion here in Los Angeles, but the contact that people living in isolated and marginalized communities have with public services are police, and even welfare itself becomes increasingly criminalized. And I think that this investment in law enforcement, crime control, social control, surveillance as the kind of dominant urban policy, we see the transition and the process begin to happen in Carter, but in Reagan, it really, really takes hold. And the major federal policies that are introduced during his administration, especially the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1988, really set us firmly on the path to the major prison explosion that we see in the 90s and the kind of criminalization of citizens with criminal records. So this really begins a new threshold for the undoing of many of the gains of the civil rights movement.
And in addition to that, you also have this sort of this growing relationship between the military and the cops, which was a pretty new thing in a sense of actually there being not just sort of, oh yeah, thanks for letting us know what you're doing, but they're actually working together in a massive assault on black and brown mm-hmm. people across the country.
Mm-hmm. So part of it is that Reagan begins to tighten the borders, especially the southeast border, to prevent cocaine from coming into the United States. But ironically, more cocaine actually comes in during his tenure than before. I mean, so part of it is these policies, and the book kind of asks us to question, why have we continued to embrace these sets of punitive policies, even though they have failed. I think especially now, and I wish that the Trump administration would consider this instead of continuing these policies that we know fail and that many police chiefs around the country know have failed and don't work to control crime. We really need to think, okay, so the hard-nosed, militarized police and the zero-tolerance policies haven't worked, so let's try a more preventative approach that really places social welfare and socioeconomic reform or transformation at the center of our approach to urban policy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elizabeth Hinton. Elizabeth is the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America.
Let me ask you this, because there's a couple of things that I want people to understand what this has meant in real life for people. It's really important because, you know, you look at the prison statistics and you don't understand I thought one of the things that was really helpful in your book is that when you get through the book, when you're going through the book, you actually, there's points where you present exactly what's the prison population today? Who makes it up? How did they get there? All of these kinds of things. Because here's the thing, nothing has been sitting still since the days of Reagan. When Reagan was in, this stuff began. It's continued all the way through. It's continued through every administration you have, and it's reached its apex right now in Trump. And there's a whole way that this goes, and it falls out, like, for instance, in schools. The schools that were, you know, if you live somewhere in, like, Wonderland, you're sort of, you know, you're thinking about, well, schools, you know, you get up, and you might not like your teacher, but you go to school and do whatever, you know? But when you're talking about the people that were living under the gun and the many guns and under the, you know, just the raining down of drugs and all these other things and the mass incarceration, all of this, when you're living under there, schools actually come to mean something else. And when you're actually talking about the way that people have been treated and what was given rise to through, as we were talking about earlier, about the cops and the role that they play in actually helping to bring in. It's funny that you mentioned cocaine, because I was in Miami during the last rebellion I had in 89. And one of the things that happened while I was there was that these police had all, you know, they showed up one night and, you know, on the river, there was this boat, and these cops pulled up to the boat, and they got out and they had all these homeless guys that they got, and they put them there and they unloaded a bunch of packages, and they spent the entire night doing it. And then all these guys were killed. And I can't remember exactly how they found out it was the cops that did it, but the cops had just taken all of this coke and they disappeared with it. And when they were caught and they were put on trial and they knew they were going to get convicted, so they kind of all disappeared. They all happened to have, you know, they had posted bail and they walked away. You know, so you're looking at all this stuff, and I'm thinking about the schools and what happens in these schools. And Crenshaw High School, there was a very moving piece you did around Crenshaw High School in terms of what was actually going on there and what had been unleashed there. And kids are not kids anymore when they're, you know, they are kids, but they're living a life of terror in a lot of ways. And that was all hooked up with the flowering of this whole insane drug-fueled, and actually even more important than drug-fueled, a really insidious and killing, basically acting towards black people. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the way it goes now. It's not a question of black people have a right to live. It's a lot of, in this administration that's here now, it's who says they have a right to live? Mm-hmm. They cause more trouble than anything else, you know? And so you're looking at these schools in a situation that was in the aftermath of Reagan, or during Reagan, but then aftermath under Bush and all this other stuff. And what was going on is that more and more, you got these schools where people couldn't go to school. One of the places you write about is Crenshaw High School. Mm-hmm. It was really moving to read that.
Yeah, I mean, and this is as early as the 1970s. And again, it's this kind of, it's based on this assumption about blackness and criminality, and as you mentioned, the devaluing and the lack of care, the benign neglect, in Daniel Patrick Moynihan's words, of towards black people on the part of policymakers and black life, where schools like Crenshaw become, and housing projects become, fortified in new ways that, you know, you begin to get the gates and you begin to get actually a security industry that's focused on how to better surveil certain schools in targeted communities. And you get housing projects that are being fortified in new ways too. And this is in the 70s. This is before kind of the height of when we think about crime and drugs and social harm in low-income communities of color. And it goes into not only the self-fulfilling prophecy, but the impact of living in a place that does feel like a fortress, like Crenshaw at that time was called Fort Crenshaw. The impact of that, like how can you get an what does it mean to get an education with bars in the window or walking through a metal detector, even when those, in some ways, and I think a lot of people today would even say that, well, those those surveillance or those bars are there for our own protection because the neighborhood is dangerous. And so this keeps us safe while we go to school. Well, what if instead of investing in hidden cameras for school buses and metal detectors and tasers and all kinds of other things that were used against students, what if we invested in first-rate books and really good teachers? And, you know, we think about failing public schools. American public schools aren't bad across the board. They're bad in some areas, and those areas tend to be low-income communities. They're not, you know, some of the suburban schools in the United States are the best in the world. So again, it has to do with our priorities, our responses to socioeconomic problems, and this larger, the kind of larger impact of living in a community that has been so severely criminalized over a period of time. What is the impact of that generationally?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that's going to tell you too is that I did some work just writing about this, some students down at Locke High School, because at Locke, when you come there, and this actually impacts a lot of immigrant students. And when you go to Locke, if you're late, they shut the gate. They lock the gate. And you can't get in. If you're a minute late, 50 seconds late, they shut the gate. And they give you a ticket, you know, and if you get and your parents then have to take off work to come back and try to, and settle it all out. So these kids basically don't get the ticket. They just don't. If they make it to the gate, and who knows why they couldn't make it to the gate on time, it could have been an emergency at home. It could have been anything.
Right.
You know, they get there, they're blocked. You get inside the thing. There is, I'll tell you, I walked through the halls there on every floor, cameras in every direction. Mm-hmm. You're being filmed. You know, a friend of mine was a teacher there, and she was fired because they used to do these things where they would give everybody a number. They would pick a number. They would have the numbers of a bunch of numbers in the office, and the principal would pick a number, or the head of security would pick a number, and any room that had that number in its thing, like if it was the number was 2, and any room that was like either 22, 202, 123, they would get a surprise visit by the school police and the security person in touch the school. And they would go in and they would demand that people should, they would, you know, frisk people. They would look at everything they had. So my friend said, absolutely not. And first she locked the door, then they went out and they knocked the door down and they got another key or something. They got in. And the last thing she said was she was forewarned that this was going to happen, she would tell the kids, we're going on a picnic today. So they would all leave, right? And they'd walk outside so the cops couldn't find them. But the one day that she didn't get a chance to do that, she was dragged out of her classroom and just, she had to tell the people, remember what I've taught you. You do not have to do this. And so all these kids refused to let the cops look through their book bags, to through their desks or anything, right? But it became a big thing, and unfortunately not big enough, because I'm sure that kind of stuff still exists around here. I have one more question for you. I know it's
okay.
We're gonna have some.
We could talk all afternoon.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you this because I was always blown away by this when I came out here, and you talk about it to a certain extent in just as one of the things, and it sort of poetically captures something here, right? Because there is the Operation Cul-de-Sac, which to me was extremely important. And I remember when I came out here and just seeing this, and I was like, what do you mean we can't go down? I got to walk that way. No. This is good. But people, and it really institutionalized the feeling of prison for a lot of people in these neighborhoods, mm-hmm. You know, and you didn't see them on, you know, out in Pacific Heights or something, or Pacific Palisades. You didn't see it out there. You saw it in Pico Union. You saw it in Watts. You saw it other places. It was a concentration of everything we've been talking about in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that is a very overt manifestation of the ways in which entire communities get criminalized and can't go about their daily lives and are policed for ordinary everyday activity, not for all Americans, for low-income Black and Latino Americans living in certain communities and on certain blocks, everything they do is policed. And there are a lot, again, this devaluing of Black life. There's almost this assumption that there's a right to police, based on this idea of innate criminality, anyone's a potential criminal. You know, this is something that becomes kind of part of the status quo and accepted. I'm living in South LA right now, and this weekend on Sunday morning, there was a helicopter that just was flying around from about 10 o'clock in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. And I, you know, it, And helicopters aren't as common as they were in Operation Cul-de-Sac days, but it's just, that would never happen in Beverly Hills. And it's something that we all just kind of deal with and get used to. But then what is the long-term impact of that, especially in a community where so many residents are incarcerated upstate?
So why don't you tell us what Operation Cul-de-Sac is?
So Operation Cul-de-Sac was a program of the Los Angeles Police Department that was initiated in the early 90s. And essentially, police, and this is kind of after the major gang sweeps that happened in the late 80s, early 90s, where basically thousands of black men were processed in mobile command units through the criminal justice system because they were potentially or suspected gang members. And so following that operation, which got a lot of criticism, the LAPD set up Operation Cul-de-Sac, which essentially established barricades in uncertain streets in certain neighborhoods so that when you were driving on the street or walking on the street, the police could stop you. It essentially reorganized the neighborhood to allow the LAPD to better monitor and police that community.
Mm-hmm. All right, Elizabeth Hinton, the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. All right. All right. That's once again, that was Elizabeth Hinton, the author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. All right. Listen up, folks. We got a lot of decisions to make, as I pointed out in the beginning of the show, and we got a lot standing before. The world is going to hell. All right. And you have a part in making sure that that don't happen. All right, we've got some time left, and what we're going to do is take a musical break right now and be right back with a short piece by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
I waited all my life to play, but I still can't find a way. But if I work it one more day, I might just break the chain. I might just break the chain.
All right, welcome back. That was Lupe Fiasco with Break the Chain. And right now, I want to play you a piece from Bob Avakian. It's the trailer of a talk by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. So here's the trailer for the film, which you can access from revcom.us.
Why we need an actual revolution and how we can really make revolution. How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? White supremacy, male supremacy, wars of empire, the demonization, criminalization, and deportations of immigrants, the destruction of the planet, why is this the state of humanity? There is one fundamental reason. The basic nature of the system of capitalism, imperialism that we live under, and the way, because of its very nature, it continually perpetrates and perpetuates horror after horror. And in fundamental terms, we have two choices. Either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same or worse, if they have a future at all, or make revolution. An actual revolution does not mean trying to make some changes within this system. It means overthrowing this system and bringing into being a radically different and far better system. A revolution aiming not just to abolish oppression, exploitation, poverty, and misery in one country, but having as its fundamental goal the abolition of all this throughout the world and the elimination of all borders and boundaries that erect walls between the different parts of humanity. Let's be honest. This is a difficult road, but there is no other way to finally put an end to the horrors that are continually brought forth by this system. And as hard as this is, it is possible if we go about it the right way, with the right outlook and approach, the right goals and methods, the right strategy and plan. So this is what I'm going to dig into through the course of this talk. Revolution is possible, and we have to go to work to make it real.
That was Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and the film was Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. This can be seen at revcom.us. And really, get your friends together, get everybody you know, tell people you don't know. Check out this film. It's the kind of thing we need in the air and in our heads right now. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank Elizabeth Hinton, and I'd also like to thank all of the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and engineer, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. Now, if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more revolutionary music. This is Chairman Fred, I Wish I Was Fred Hampton by Ted Sirota and the Rebel Souls. Talk to you again next week.
We're talking about a beat that can't be stopped by anybody.
I'm the Deputy Chairman of the State of Illinois. You dare struggle, you dare win, you dare not struggle, the goddamn thing.
I wouldn't stop doing what I'm doing. It's all a free.
Be acting like pigs, just acting like people, and moving on pigs, that's what we've got to do. Food is not important, and work is not important. Nothing's more important than stopping fascism, because fascism will stop us all. And we are going to have to fight, we're going to have to struggle, we're going to have to struggle relentlessly to bring about some peace, because the people that we're asking for peace, they are a bunch of people.